सोच विचार के साथ। मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। एज यू नो, सोच विचार ट्राइज टू डेवलप ideas and thinking on the latest concepts on growth and development. We have done a number of subjects, but one subject that I've always felt that we should go into a lot deeper is entrepreneurship. When I was at the Planning Commission in 2011 to 13, we took up the concept of entrepreneurship very seriously, and I found that many people in Pakistan just did not understand this issue. I therefore called Phil Auerswald to talk about it. Phil Auerswald is a professor at George Mason University. He also leads the Global Entrepreneurship Initiative at the Kauffman Institute. He also is the editor of the Innovation Journal. He has written a couple of interesting books, very interesting books. One is called The Coming Prosperity. The other is called A new book, which I think is fascinating and a must read, is called The Code Economy. It is a history of the 40,000 years of human development. And as you would argue, it's probably a longer history of human development. And I think we need to take such histories very seriously. This is a subject very close to my heart, and we will have hopefully a very interesting conversation with Phil. But as always, no conversation is complete. All conversations leave a lot of issues and thoughts to be discussed, and perhaps ideas for you people to throw into your research and into your general educational debate. So the conversation of Soch Pichar is on, and let's talk to Phil Auerswald. Welcome to Soch Pichar, Phil Auerswald. Hi, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Phil. You remember you came to Pakistan in 2012 or 11, I think. And you spent some time with us, and you worked on entrepreneurship in Pakistan, and you also produced a video. Tell me about that. What was your experience like? What did you learn? What do you think of, you know, policy, entrepreneurship, all kinds of things about Pakistan? Let's begin by discussing Pakistan.
Yeah, so actually, Nadeem, what I remember is how the whole thing got started, which, as you recall, was on Twitter.
Absolutely, I recall that. So please tell us. Tell everybody about that.
Yeah, so we had gotten connected at about the time when the Sachs-Easterly exchanges were particularly intense on Twitter. And so you had this sort of aid effectiveness or aid skepticism, mm-hmm. Back and forth. Mm-hmm. But there were a few people, and we were, I think, some of the very few, who were asking, why are we even talking about aid as a driver of development? Where in the world has aid been the actual driver of development, plus or minus? And so, so we really had an affinity over, Mansur Olson and, sort of thinking about institutions and thinking about incentives and entrepreneurship as being drivers of development. And so we had been planning to get together just because we, sort of shared similar perspectives on the process of development. Mm-hmm. And then you sent me a message and said, Phil, I can't get together. I'm going to Pakistan next week. I'll be in touch when I get there. Mm-hmm. And then you got in touch with me in the middle of the night, like 1 o'clock in the morning. You said, I happen to be up working. And you say, Phil, I need your help. You have to come to Pakistan. So that's how that project got started.
So I hope that experience was worthwhile.
It was very worthwhile. I mean, I was upfront to you that I had never been to Pakistan. I knew nothing about mm-hmm. the institutional context. And, mm-hmm. And you said, look, just come, with fresh eyes, talk to some people mm-hmm. and, just write up what you see. Mm-hmm. And that will be your contribution. So I was, delighted to do that. I had a chance to meet Monis Rahman, Seema Aziz. I mean, I remember those discussions, very well. I think those are still two of the most impressive entrepreneurs I've ever met. The discussion we had with Seema Aziz is one that, I think about frequently. And I think the entire experience of seeing a country, you know, reminded me of being in China in the early 90s. I mean, I was first in China in 1986. I think Pakistan's well past that point, but sort of like the mid 90s type, you know, energy of a country that's just sort of in transition towards something.
That's really nice, huh?
And well, you know, we don't know that the story is going to continue from mid 1990s, you know, the way it has in China. We hope it will. But I feel like that similar energy of something on the cusp. And
so tell me, if you were to summarize what you learned in Pakistan and what you put in your report, how would you summarize, let's say two or three or whatever, few key points on what your analysis of Pakistan's entrepreneurship was and how you saw it and what you see is the way forward?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that struck me, and again, to you know your audience, this will seem like a quintessential outsider's observation, but you know, I was astonished to see you know the neighborhoods that in Washington D.C. would have been you know the Bethesda, the McLean, you know the sort of you know upscale aspirational neighborhoods, you know called Defense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to learn about the history of that and to understand, you know, the role of you know, the military and the economy and really, you know, the institutional obstacles to entrepreneurship. And so what I took away from that was really one of the themes of, you know, your work at the Planning Commission, which was around competition. And in fact, that's what our study was really focused on. It was competition and entrepreneurship. But from then forward, whenever I speak at an audience, you know, whether it's a World Bank, a USAID, any kind of development audience, I say, look, you know, if you want to support entrepreneurs, there's one policy. Your number one, two, and three policy is the same: favor incumbents less. And you know that so you can have whatever you know seed stage program you want, or you know support accelerators, or you know do events you know to celebrate entrepreneurs. And I think those are all great things to do. I spend a lot of my time in that world with that, you know, advocating for just those types of things. But when you have a setting like you know like Pakistan with tremendous possibilities and tremendous unmet service needs within the country, I think favoring incumbents less is the best entrepreneurship policy, and of course the most difficult.
Now, Phil, you have been the reason I sort of we met and talked about everything on Twitter and why you came to Pakistan is because I found this amazing spark in you, which I learned from and which I've subsequently sort of caught on to, that entrepreneurship is the key to development, whereas most people have been talking about aid and building up capital and building up things. You are arguing that entrepreneurship is a major route to development and growth. And I should add that that's something that also that Schumpeter said a long time ago. And recently, people like Agin and Howitt have also said that. Now, how do you sum up the role of entrepreneurship and what is entrepreneurship? Please define that for us too.
So, I mean, I think of you know, entrepreneur. I'm very old school when it comes to that. I you know, think about you know, building, creating, and growing a company. What type of companies and what type of entrepreneurship are we focused on? You know, then I'm really a Schumpeterian, and I think about entrepreneurs, you know, creative entrepreneurs as being the people in the economy who create new combinations. But I think that, you know, I have recently, in part as a communications vehicle, but increasingly, you know, fairly literally as a modeling approach and conceptual approach, I really think about it in terms of ecosystems. And so when we think about entrepreneurship. I mean, if you go into a rainforest, for example, you know, you see the big trees, you know, and you see the scrub that's sort of, you know, around the bottom of the rainforest. The scrub's never going to grow very much. And the big trees, the canopy, you know, if you look at the rainforest from the sky, that's all you see, you know, GE, Walmart, whatever. That seems like it's the entire economy. So that scrub that doesn't grow much, you know, that's small business. You know, large corporations are the canopy. But entrepreneurship is almost in a different category altogether, which is what's small and growing. And that's why I talk about favor incumbents less, because if you've got something that's essentially dead, but you've got steel girders up around it, you know, to kind of keep it from toppling over, then it's neither growing nor letting sunlight through so that something else can grow. right? You have to let what is actually dead fall over. Now, what happens when, you know, an old tree falls over? Well, what happens is that it rots and it releases nutrients, and those nutrients are recombined into a new tree or a new vegetation of some other type, right? And entrepreneurship is that process of taking spare resources, underutilized resources, you know, liberated resources in the economy, and recombining them into something that's vibrant. And so entrepreneurship may seem like a small part of the economy. At any point in time, entrepreneurial ventures are a small fraction, but they're critical to the vitality of the economy. Just the same way that in a rainforest, out of the entire biomass, only a small fraction will be new and growing trees. Most of it's in the canopy or in scrub that's really never going to grow. But without those new and growing trees, The forest is not alive.
That's so, very graphic and very interesting. I mean, you've put it very nicely, Phil, that basically, first of all, you say that favor incumbents less.
Yeah.
Secondly, think of it as a forest ecosystem where there are tall trees maturing and growing, and the little ferns and shrubs, etc., underneath are trying to find their way in. And if you favor the tall incumbents, the little ones will die. And if you don't, then the natural process will take shape. But tell me, how does that square with the process of development that has taken place, where we have tried to pick winners and losers, and secondly, where we do fund businesses to grow? I mean, there are all kinds of institutions like the International Finance Corporation, development financial institutions that do tend to grow industry. And then another related question is, major thinkers like, for example, Danny Roderick or Justin Lin, the former vice president of the World Bank, talk about an industrialization policy. Now, how do you square this with an industrialization policy and the policy of the IFC or the DFIs to grow industry?
So on the margin, it's going to make more sense. You're going to create new jobs. Mm-hmm. You're going to create more new jobs by industrial policy. Mm-hmm. It will seem to work better in the short term. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, and Roderick talks about building a consensus, an industrial policy consensus, and really finding those people who are the business leaders to help to identify the sectors that have the greatest promise for growth and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. I'll look up in a minute his 1995 paper. Mm-hmm. That really was the first paper that, at least to my knowledge, that he published around industrial policy. Right. And it focused on South Korea. Mm-hmm. And in that paper, he's very clear about how exceptional South Korea was. Mm-hmm. South Korea was an economically completely flat country because it had been destroyed by, 60 years of colonization and then a world war and a civil war, and there was really nothing left. So there were no incumbent interests to distort the process of defining industrial policy. So I think that if you really look at the evolution of Roderick's work on industrial policy, the best contribution to my mind was the first one, where it was really very explicit about the preconditions that are required to do that type of consultation. So otherwise, you just favor incumbents more and you undermine the long-term prospects of development because you don't allow for entrepreneurship.
But tell me, could you have an industrial policy without favoring somebody? And if you do, then favoring somebody means, in a sense, that you are in that ecosystem providing some benefit to somebody who's likely to grow faster than somebody who may be more innovative. Isn't that right?
All right. Well, so I'm going to step back from my metaphor now because, I mean, let's just agree, I have a sort of set of principles here. Now, in terms of just pragmatism, is it possible to have a policy that does not favor one interest or another from a practical standpoint? Mm-hmm. And I think it's extremely difficult. whether you know, whether through design or through unintended consequence, you know, policy is going to you know, is going to have the effect of favoring one interest or another. So, I mean, I'm you know, I think we can be realistic about that. I was you know, for a long time you know, involved in more involved than I am now in sort of industrial policy related initiatives in the United States. For example, the Advanced Technology Program run by the Department of Commerce. And you know, I think that the notion of having you know, well-defined verticals, for example, in this country, I would say it's healthcare to the home, you know, mobile in-home health services, is a domain where you know, I would say we should be favoring healthcare to the home. We should be structuring our you know, healthcare reimbursement policies, our R&D policies, you know, an array of policies in order to favor the provision of healthcare in the home. And I think that for the United States, the fiscal viability of the country, the you know, health and wellness of the growing fraction of the you know, country that's over, you know, whatever you want to call it, 60, you know, all depends on having a new infrastructure of health services that's not hospital based, that's not inpatient. So to me, that's an example of where
saying then is that basically what we want to do is create a policy to provide for a certain need that currently is not being provided for. So in a sense, policy determines what society needs through careful research, through careful understanding, and then incentivizes, let's say, healthcare in home, right?
Right.
And
right.
Then entrepreneurs rise to fulfill that need.
Right, right, right. So, you know, I mean, you know, was it Thoreau who said consistency is the hobgoblin of foolish minds? So I've just said one thing. Now I'll say the opposite thing, which is that in some instances, actually, you know, making a clearing, you know, creating that, like what you know, we titled our report, creating a place for the future. Right. Sometimes creating a place for the future is you have to sort of, you know, make that space. You talked about creating market spaces in cities. Mm-hmm. That's activist government policy. You're trying to favor market spaces. You're trying to favor agricultural spaces, meeting spaces, creating space, creative spaces. I mean, you had a lot of, you know, great insights, you know, that, you know, that were in the report, you know, that came out of
time and growth.
That, you know, the framework for economic growth that came out of your time, you know, in the Planning Commission. And those were very active policies and, you know, ones with which I thought, you know, I was very much in agreement. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, there's always going to be this tendency of policy, either, you know, deliberately or inadvertently to, you know, to favor. But we really, then it's a question of who do you trust? How do you find that research that you believe in? Where do you find the Sima Azizes and the Monis Rahmans, who are people of just, you know, absolute integrity, who can give a perspective on what it takes for business to serve survive that you can believe in? And those are valuable people in any society.
But let me ask you a question. Again, returning to the definition of entrepreneurship, I got your analogy, but let's define it a little further. Does entrepreneurship always require two things, innovation and risk-taking? Or can entrepreneurship, in a sense, be sitting in a comfort zone favored by the government and, you know, kind of like we have in, for example, in Pakistan, in many countries, we have this, that the incumbents have been given licenses, have been given credit, have been given all kinds of advantages, and they call themselves entrepreneurs and they say, hey, we provided employment, etc. But I think the Schumpeterian definition would be more risk-taking in entrepreneurship. Which way would you go?
Well, you know, I think your listeners probably know the William Baumol paper from 1990. You know, William Baumol at NYU, you know, the great scholar of entrepreneurship in recent generations.
This year, yeah. Huh? He died last year or earlier this year, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And And, you know, he wrote a paper in 1990, titled Entrepreneurship, Productive, Unproductive, and Destructive. Mm-hmm. And that's a very important paper for anybody in the entrepreneurship. It's a foundational paper for those of us in the entrepreneurship field, because, what we're talking about is productive entrepreneurship. We're talking about creating new combinations, exploiting those open spaces, recombining resources, building the new. And that's wonderful, right? Then there's unproductive, which is rent seeking. And, you know, the entrepreneurship did not disappear, for example, in the Soviet Union. It doesn't disappear in environments where there are rent-seeking opportunities, that abound. And one can really prosper by finding those and exploiting them. And I would say, it is entrepreneurial. It's indistinguishable when you look at the activity. It looks very much like productive entrepreneurship. And destructive entrepreneurship, we think about, human trafficking or narcotics or any of the sort of trades that, in terms of their first and second order effects in society, we can say they are destructive. They're destructive of human lives. They're destructive of human aspirations. But people prosper in their conduct, and it requires a tremendous amount of savvy and organization and risk-taking in order to be successful. So not all entrepreneurship is in the productive category. I think everything we've been talking about, you could say it is this sort of subset of entrepreneurship that is productive. And the whole point of policy, the whole point of institutions, is to make productive entrepreneurship seem more appealing than unproductive or destructive. And in most places, many places, that's still not the case.
I think that's very well put, Phil. In fact, you have just given me a very good opening into policy. What you've described is a situation, as Baumol said, that you've got productive and unproductive. You've got the mafia on the one side and you've got the Bill Gates on the other side, kind of thing. Now, in many countries, for example, in war situations, you have rent seeking happening because people are trying to black market things, etc. Similarly, in a controlled economy like the Soviet Union, you see that happening. Similarly, in economies where you don't have good institutions, you have rent seeking and other things happening because of the institutional structure. Now, one of the reasons that the U.S. and the West has taken off, as North and other people point out, is because they've got a good setup, institutional setup, which allows people to exploit entrepreneurship. And the way you put it is very nicely. Now, tell me, your study of entrepreneurship also made you very optimistic. You wrote a book called The Coming Prosperity, which is all about entrepreneurship. Tell me about it. Why are you optimistic about the future?
Yeah, well, I probably never should have written a book with that title because the whole notion of being an optimist is very, tedious. I sort of think about it like, an optimist is somebody who's always late. A pessimist is somebody who's always early. What you want is to be with people who are on time. It doesn't really help you if they arrive half an hour in advance because they were so panicked that, maybe the bus wouldn't come or whatever. Mm-hmm. And people who are always late are even more tedious. Mm-hmm. So I really don't, I don't think, there's any merit or value in optimism per se. But there is merit and value in looking at the data broadly. Mm-hmm. And, I do think that, in fact, I've tracked research on this. It's a claim that I think one can substantiate that because we are animals that grew up on the savannah and we're trying to figure out what lions are about to kill us. And, as a species, just genetically tend to, favor information that is short term, threat based and extreme. Mm-hmm. And it's just, we just find it more interesting. So, long-term, non-threat-based, and moderated. So any trend that occurs, for example, the shift from population growth to population decline, mm-hmm. is probably the number one thing happening in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. I think it's the driver of, a lot of what we see in developed countries. It's sort of a driver of the collapse of the real rate of return, which I don't think is ever going to come back so that we can expect 5%, interest in rich countries on our certificates of deposit. I think that this trend is of such great significance, and yet it's almost totally ignored. Mm-hmm. So that's what the Coming Prosperity is about. I mean, I started the project in 2008, mm-hmm. and I was looking at, you know, all of the, you know, okay, admittedly, you know, warranted, sense of concern over the collapse of the housing bubble, but it was a bubble. I mean, anybody who didn't think that it was a bubble was making a serious mistake. And then we're still talking about, you know, how have we returned to peak? Well, we're talking to comparing to the peak of a bubble. So I was sort of looking, contrasting that with the experience I'd had, as we were just talking about, in Pakistan, and seeing what, you know, the way China had changed since 1986, since I first lived there. And I just felt like it was sad to look at, you know, people in this country who haven't had those experiences, haven't had a chance to see the sort of change that's happening around the world, to be under the illusion that this is some sort of era of, of poverty and decay, when it's really, that's the reason I titled the way it is, really the era in which more people have been brought out of poverty in the last quarter century than in all of human history combined. More progress has been made in advancing the human history in the last quarter century than in all human history combined. And I don't think that that's likely to change for another 25, 30 years. Now, what happens in rich countries is an entirely different story. But I was talking about the coming prosperity globally on a time scale of, say, 25 to 40 years. That's what that title was about.
Basically, what you were saying, I guess, if I interpret it, is that the world is sitting on a precipice where people can come out of poverty through entrepreneurship, through innovation, through risk-taking. And if only we can get a globalization right and a policy framework right, we should be able to include more and more people in the game of market, in the game of entrepreneurship. Is that the kind of thought that you had in mind? And is that what you were driving at?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, when Japan grew, it brought, you know, sort of 30-40 million people out of poverty. Right. Then China grew and it brought 300-400 million people out of poverty. Yeah. You know, bringing the world along is 3 billion people.
Yeah.
That's how many people were in poverty, you know. So when this next phase of global growth that brings everybody along is the biggest, and I still think that we're at the beginning. You know, when you look at, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, and you look at the demographic trends there, that's where almost all of the population growth globally is going to be happening.
No, not only growth, Phil, just to substantiate your point, there's still about 4 or 5 billion people out there who really have to exploit their potential.
Exactly.
To be able to find their level in terms of exploiting their talents. There are talents out there that need to be exploited. And in some sense, I agree with you. Entrepreneurship is about finding talent and exploiting it.
Yep. Now, you said back one point I wanted to make, though, is that you were talking about whether entrepreneurship is this, productive. And like we talked about Baumol and so forth. But I, in my most recent book, which we haven't gotten to yet, The Code Economy, a 40,000-year history, I've spent a lot of time in that book talking about culinary recipes and, you know, culinary entrepreneurship. And I actually think that we can learn more about entrepreneurship by simply thinking about kitchens and restaurants and cooks and chefs as we can, you know, about thinking, you know, about apps and coding and all the rest of that. I mean, that you know, everything, you know, we think about new combinations and differentiation in markets and, you know, the difference between a cook, which is really a manager, and a chef, or, you know, a restaurateur, you know, who's really sort of an entrepreneur, a creator. I mean, these are very different jobs, very different, I'd say ways of being in the world, not necessarily even jobs. And I think that culinary entrepreneurship is really becoming just such an important area, you know, in so many places, in terms of really driving the entrepreneurial frontier. And when you talk about all of the people in the world realizing their possibilities, it's definitely not everybody, you know, building a technology business. It's every type of creative endeavor, and it's entrepreneurship in its broadest form of just, you know, more like getting to the fundamentals, you know, as you were saying, about everybody realizing their creative potential, you know, and being in an environment where they can do that. And you know, we're still very, very far from that.
So tell me, what your latest book, Code Economy? Let's take that up since you brought it up. What do you mean by the code economy? What I understand is you're talking about software, but you say, no, you're talking about culinary things. So please explain the thesis there.
So, yeah, I mean, I was interested in writing a book that would engage in, you know, the debate on, you know, future of work and digital disruption and robots and AI and so forth. I mean, when I was writing the book, there was a book every 2 weeks on this topic. Now I think it's a book every 2 days. Mm-hmm. So you know, just by, you know, sort of a topical focus, one, you know, can't expect to make, you know, some huge contribution. But what interested me increasingly was, you know, first I look back to sort of the 1960s, and Herbert Simon, you know, wrote a book called The Shape of Automation for Men and Machines, which is still better than almost any book written on this topic today, including mine. His is a lot shorter, for one thing. And, you know, there were congressional committees on the effects of automation in the 1960s, and sort of, you know, a huge debate on this. And then you go back to the 1920s, and Paul Douglas of Cobb Douglas Production Function fame wrote important papers on the effects of automation. You know, you go back further to the early 19th centuries, and you have the Luddites, and I talk about in my book, you know, Lord Byron was actually the first person, I think he may have been the first person to make a public policy speech about the effects of automation. He spoke in favor of the Luddites and against the death penalty for people who were machine breakers. And then as I sort of traced this story back, you know, I ended up basically at 2 million BC. That's what happens when you're writing a book. But, you know, for me, code is any algorithm of production.
Okay.
And so when we think about computer code, digital code, it's one version of that. But code, the best example, the definitive example of code is a recipe. It's simply you take ingredients, you put them together, and you make something of higher value. And a culinary recipe, I mean, you think about the conventional model in economics is, you know, we have inputs. And so that's kind of the list of ingredients you have in the recipe. And then you have outputs, you know, sort of how many cookies or, you know, servings of, you know, whatever it is that you're planning on serving your guests, you know, how many you can make. But you really don't have a recipe book in the world that I know of, even, you know, the first ever printed, that doesn't also have the set of instructions, like what you actually do with the ingredients. And that's an algorithm. Mm-hmm. That's a process, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And so, and any kind of manual, you know, a McDonald's manual for a franchisee is an algorithm. It's a set of instructions that you follow. If you were a, you know, a silversmith and you were an apprentice, you would learn processes. They would be tacit. They would be conveyed verbally. They weren't in a patent. You know, they weren't in standard operating procedures. But humans have been engaging in production using repeatable processes that are communicated in a structured way for as long as there's been human civilization. And so it's the evolution of those codes that has always interacted with human capabilities and has always been a driver of human progress. And so that's what this book is about, is I call it a 40,000 year history, but actually, as I say, you know, in ultimately, it's, you know, 2 million years, it's 2 million years. It's really, well, I can tell you why that is, but I mean, it's 2 million years.
But yeah. Isn't what you're saying roughly equivalent to that the technology itself is a set of algorithms? Right, a car is an algorithm if you think about it, or the computer, or this mic that we are talking through is an algorithm, right? And in some sense, if you extend it further, DNA and all of nature is a sense of algorithm. So, I mean, there are people who argue, and it's probably a defensible argument, that all of order or whatever we have around us that we can see, whether trees or whatever, or cars or people, they're all algorithms or information that is structured in a certain sense. Well, an algorithm is nothing but a structured information, right?
It gets pretty deep, yeah? Actually, yeah. Because yeah. You're exactly right. Yeah. I mean, first of all, the word technology, the word technology derives from a combination of techne, the Greek word techne, that signifies art, craft, or trade. The second half of technology derives from the word logos, which is an ordered account or reasoned discourse. So the word technology literally means an ordered account of art, craft, or trade, which is essentially a recipe. right? That's what technology is. It's structuring. It's structuring in just the way that you said. Now, you threw a tree in there. So we might say, well, a tree is not technology in the sense that it's not human created.
Right.
But you have a program mm-hmm. that created the tree.
Exactly.
It's genetic code.
Yeah.
We have a program that created us.
Yeah.
Right. And so and that gets back to the biological metaphor.
Right.
That when we think about the DNA of an economy, mm-hmm. the DNA of economy is literally code.
Yeah.
Good point. And so you know, if anyone's looking for like where does this actually become applied, like where can I get data on this, then you can look no further than at least as a starting point, certainly not as an end point, but as the, you know, the Hausmann-Hidalgo atlas of economic complexity. And that they have the beginning there. I have enormous respect for that work because they were able to get a start mm-hmm. on finding data that could talk about capabilities, that could talk about the economy as the evolution of code. Is their approach, their trade-based approach, is it the only way of thinking about this? Is it the last word? Of course not. But they were able to empirically articulate something.
And, very important and start empirical something. Approach, yeah.
Very important to get that started. So I, you know, I think that that's a great kind of
but
anchor.
Let me run another thing by you. Think about it. For example, we talk about institutions a la North or Williamson or whatever. The Constitution, for example, or the legal rules or whatever, the various structures of society around which we work, right? I mean, all of our society is organized on principles, which we call institutions, or rules, which we call institutions. They themselves are a code book that we've defined. And we should be able to, in some sense, understand that as code too and work with it. And that brings us back to Baumol's point. Can we create a code that is more conducive to entrepreneurship, or will we live in the old feudal code where entrepreneurship was not rewarded, but all kinds of rent-seeking and feudal patronage was rewarded?
So I do think, when you're in the biological metaphor, mm-hmm. then I think it helps to sort of structure the complexity of the world. So, mm-hmm. or actually, let's approach it from culinary innovation. Mm-hmm. You have a recipe, right? Mm-hmm. And any night you can cook whatever you want. You go and buy what you want, and sort of your meals can change at a fairly rapid rate. Mm-hmm. The institutions within that provide your capacity to cook, you know, a grocery store, you know, all the supply chains that get the food to you. That's the institutional structure that creates the context for your cooking. That changes more slowly than the cooking itself,
yeah.
Right? Even a new restaurant, you know, is a lot more difficult than a new recipe. Mm-hmm. And then what changes the most slowly is the way that we eat, how we think about a meal. So, you know, there's four of us around the table or, you know, six or whatever. And, you know, we have silverware and we, you know, begin with salad or we end with salad or, you know, whatever it is that we're doing, you know, in terms of what a culture expects of a meal, right? And that, I think, is culture. So you have these layers. Some things can change very quickly, some things less quickly, and some culture most slowly of all, right? So I don't think we can expect everything to change on the same time scale is what I'm saying. And although there is a code for institutions, it's a platform code. It's something that is more difficult to change because more things depend on it. And so that's why changing institutions is so hard. That's why changing platforms is so hard. Extremely important, but we can't expect it to happen overnight.
I fully agree with you on the time scale, but I think it's important to think of the institutions and the constructs of society as recipes or algorithms so that we can begin to understand them. Right now, they appear
yes.
to be kind of ephemeral and you know, you say rules and we kind of then move on to other things. We really don't understand them in that sense. Let me give you an example. Think about Afghanistan, for example, where the U.S. tried to do some state building, or Iraq, right? They began with the Constitution. They actually transplanted a Constitution from here to there or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's not quite working. And that's something that I think we can think of in the form of a transplanted algorithm and bring it into complexity theory.
Yeah, exactly. And understand. Exactly.
How do we do it? So reflect upon that a little. Let's see how
that's a great observation. And, you know, I do talk about, you know, legal codes and Hammurabi's code, and, you know, that is code. And I think that, you know, again, to be self-contradictory, you know, drawing some sort of hard and fast distinction between institutions and recipes probably isn't the right way to think about it. Institutions are probably much more fluid. I mean, they have their own instructions, they have their own, you know, habits, and, you know, so maybe institutions, maybe we can think of them as being more fluid than I was, you know, just a couple of minutes ago suggesting, you know, that they might be. But I think that, you know, this is so much we have to learn from failure. And the failure in Iraq, you know, was a kind of a complete and ongoing failure. But I think one of the elements was that you know, we're going to bring in a constitution, we're going to establish you know, rule of law, and then we're going to restore infrastructure, and then after that, business and it can thrive, and the economy can be successful, and people will resume normal lives and be happy in a democratic society. None of that happened, and I think there are like 1,000 reasons. But one of them is that this approach of, you know, hiring Bechtel and whoever else to go, you know, get power plants running, you know, that all that did was favor incumbents more.
Exactly.
It didn't create any economic opportunity for anybody. It didn't. We could have, you know, set up, you know, Bloom Energy servers or Tesla Energy servers or whoever else's energy servers block by block and created 10,000 small, you know, businesses in Afghanistan at 1/5 the engineering efficiency of, you know, large scale centralized, you know, generation and distribution, but at 10 times the economic efficiency, because you would be creating jobs everywhere, and every one of those power centers would have been guarded by, you know, grandma with a Kalashnikov who was, you know, no one was going to touch that because they own it. It's their business. And it wouldn't have mattered if anybody stole them because, you know, it would end up in the hands of somebody who would put it to productive use because it's an asset, and it's an asset that's movable. So, I mean, you know, again, maybe that's my own naivete, but there was no structuring of the process to scale out economic opportunity and to generate entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship leads the institutional development of a society, not the other way around. I don't think that you can find a place in the world where that hasn't been true.
I think that's absolutely correct. And that goes to the nub of what you're saying. I mean, it kind of sums up what you're saying, that look, ultimately, it's human endeavor, human entrepreneurship that requires humanity to solve their own problems through searching for algorithms that exist within nature. So I can almost picture it like a computer game. You have the analogy of a forest. Now let's think of a computer game. That here is a game where each person is searching for solutions to his own personal problem and searching for algorithms that are available in nature, recipes that are available in nature.
Right.
And what these guys were doing was they were trying to supplant this best practice approach that we have, that, hey, we found a constitution that works, the U.S. Constitution, let's put it in there. Right. And let's run with it. And then we've got all these things that we can do in a fixed format fashion. Whereas what you said in your definition of entrepreneurship and discussion was two things. A, discovering recipes, and the recipes maybe in a culinary sense vary from chef to chef. Every chef doesn't follow the same recipe. The second thing important is that, hey, everybody has their own personal tastes and whatever. We are all heterogeneous. We are different. So we have to have our own approaches to solving the problem. And it is best when you have individual entrepreneurship, you create more ownership and you solve better problems. And that, I think, was a major problem. Another important element, allow for failure. Here, there was no allowing for failure. Right. You give them a constitution that live with it now.
Yeah.
And now we are seeing the whole thing come apart in a violent way rather than, hey, guys, okay, take your time, take 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, develop a constitution, work it out, you know, or work out the various rules and institutions, etc. Is that a good way to look at things? Huh?
Yeah, well, and you know, you know, to be clear, I think that the sanctions regime and you know penalizing an entire country for the abuses of you know one particularly despicable individual wasn't particularly great either. So you can trace the failures back a long way. But I you know I loved everything you just said, Nadim, and you know your use of the term best practice. Mm-hmm. It's like if you said best meal.
Yeah.
You know, we've come up with the best meal and we're going to go serve it all over the world.
Yeah. Everybody's going to have a burger.
Everyone's going to enjoy our best meal. Yeah. You know, and people all over the world are saying, what best meal? What are we talking about? This isn't our best meal. You know, so I mean, yeah, you know, maybe there's some way that, you know, in surgery or something, you know, oral rehydration therapy, you know, maybe there's a best practice there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying that the idea of a best practice isn't completely devoid of meaning, but it's certainly, certainly way overused and most of the time not going to make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah. But that sums it up very well, Phil. I see a central theme in your growth and your development. And I'd love to see where you're going in the future because it seems that you, your entrepreneurship vision, your code vision, your recipes vision, your innovation and the failure vision, it is a kind of a well-rounded vision of social science.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
How would you like to sum it up for our listeners? And how would you like to guide them in terms of two things? One is in the research, suggest some research topics and things along the line that you're saying that they can use, because I hope my audience is young kids who could be your students in the future, who could do something interesting. It could do some interesting research. And secondly, suggest to them a good book that they can read.
Oh, wow. That's tough. There's so many good books. I'll answer that one last. It's a little bit of a cop-out. Well, it is a total cop-out because I don't think they can get to the references in my book without buying my book. And the point isn't to buy my book. But what I really tried to do in my book was integrate some of the, you know, great works that I have read. And it, to me, it's I would say it's maybe a little bit more than a literature review. But I, you know, like Learning by Doing by Jim Besson just, you know, comes to mind. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it almost like having nothing to do with anything we've talked about. But a book that I think is a tremendous book for anybody to read is Fooled by Randomness by Nassim Taleb. You know, if you're going to read a book that that nobody has read, but that's an incredible book, The Great Population Spike and After by Walt Rostow, mm-hmm. that in the U.S. at least you can get on Amazon. I mean, this is a book about the transition from population growth to population decline. But there, you know, so many great books. Anything by Herbert Simon. Mm-hmm. As far as a summary, I mean, no, Herbert Simon, you know, understood so much more about the digital economy and its implications, like I say, than 95% of what's, you know, written today. As far as a summation, I mean, I think only at the end of this discussion would I be, feel comfortable, saying this, but I think you'll understand what I mean, is that, the more I've worked in entrepreneurship and growth, the less I care about either. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that ultimately, I think you were the first person to say it in this discussion, but about, you know, the people realizing their own aspirations, mm-hmm. about like, what do you do when you get up in the morning? Mm-hmm. I've had this unbelievable luxury in my life. I mean, it's an incredible luxury and it's the thing for which I'm most grateful of having been able to, you know, pursue my own aspirations, my own dreams, but my own inclinations just to follow my own exploration and path. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that has been just sort of this inherent, wonderful thing in my life. And I've seen it in you too. Like nobody tells you what to think. You've been in institutions where you may or may not have been, you know, constrained in one way or the other, but you find your way. Yeah. And that's maybe it's just we're projecting our values onto other people, but it's not for everybody to become an academic or an entrepreneur or, you know, start a company. It's whatever that happens to be, whether it's art, literature, music, there's just, a thousand, different ways to do that. And so, so I would say that that's the number one thing. And from a research standpoint, I would also add, that, the notion of exploring the biological metaphor, mm-hmm. Is one that I think, it's not for everybody, mm-hmm. but I think it's going to be a very interesting, an exciting area of research. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing more and more done on entrepreneurial ecosystems and so forth, but not mm-hmm. just as a metaphor. Mm-hmm. The last thing I would say that's in keeping with particularly my observation, and we were just talking about it, not just being about entrepreneur. If we're talking about Pakistan, we're talking about entrepreneurship. I have to remember our friend who you introduced me to and who I met when you brought me to Pakistan, mm-hmm. Sabine Mahmood. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I've ever been, more saddened sure. by news that wasn't about my immediate family sure. Than I was, about the news, of Sabine's death. But I think you have in Sabine,
a needless death.
But the reason I bring her up is not mm-hmm. to, end on a down note. Mm-hmm. It's because, here's somebody who had all of these attributes, right. That one would want in somebody who's building the future, all the attributes of somebody who understood that it wasn't just about entrepreneurs and coding. Mm-hmm. It was about every type of creative endeavor mm-hmm. and, who literally created a space for the future mm-hmm. in Karachi and who had moral courage and who had entrepreneurial risk-taking, financial risk-taking. And, so we don't need to look too far to find examples and models of what the future can be. And I think she was one. So I just want to make sure that
I think that's absolutely a wonderful thought, because what you're saying basically is that, we find entrepreneurs in every neighborhood, in every alleyway. It's yep. only a question of giving them the room to play and the room to grow. And yep. that's where people like you and me come in, where we try and define policies for countries. I think the central message that I get from you is that people like us, when we go and define policies, we should be more sensitive to the Sabine Mahmoods who yes. are lying there as diamonds in the rough.
Yes.
And that somehow we must provide them with a framework where they can excel. Yep. Our job is to provide them with the framework for making them excel. And that's what entrepreneurship and finding the right recipe is. Unfortunately, too often what happens is we tend to put our own valuations and projections on them and kind of stifle them rather than let them grow.
Yep.
But that's a subject for another discussion, and hopefully we'll take that again. Yeah,
you've summed it up. Well, this has been a lot of fun.
You've inspired so many thoughts in me. I'll call on you again, Phil.
Yes. No, we had a lot of fun. That was really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है.